Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Here we go. Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, bullies and the bullied. How are you people? I took it. You know, Riley, I come in here in the morning.
Yes, you do.
I'm feeling a little under the weather. Everything's frozen outside. I'm trying to eat breakfast at my apartment. For some reason, at 2:30 in the morning or 3 in the morning, when I get down, I sit down in front of my computer with my bowl of cereal and my cup of tea, and one after the other, right when I'm taking spoonfuls of cereal, all three of the damn cats decide it's poop time. All right, so I got to sit there. That's how it starts. Then I come here, all right, and these guys, Larson, all right, apparently, Clutch Larson, apparently upset that he couldn't make it, that his Weight Watchers meeting was snowed in last night. He couldn't go and validate his efforts of the week, his pepper efforts, all right? I got to take some flack from him. Kalo gets on me about something. Do I got to open gash? Is this karmic return for being somewhat of a prima donna for the first 6 months?
Dude, it's all you.
What are you talking about?
I exuded something? What exactly did I exude?
I'm saying I'm exuding some vulnerability, so bam, everyone's taking a few shots.
Is that on your mind?
What do you mean?
Who do you think you are, Dan Rather?
Yeah, I think so. I see what's going on. You guys are trying to take me down.
It's his last day, not yours.
Why is Jonathan coming in here? Why is Clutch Larson in the room?
He's got something for you.
I like to support you as much as I can. Also.
Yeah. What is this?
Daily news piece. Listed before Al Franken and Janine Garofalo.
Whoa!
Everything's better. Thanks. I will keep up the good work. Hey, you look great. I don't know. Maybe you didn't make a meeting, but I think you took at least two off since last week.
Oh, Lord.
I'm Kayla, the Costco host. Sorry, buddy. Maybe you're right. Mark Riley is the only guy that didn't bust on me today.
I'm a relaxed guy. I don't bust on anybody anymore.
Brendan P.W. and McDonald didn't bust on me either. Dan Tashman got in my face a little bit. Son of Lewis and Linda Passman, New Jersey.
He always gets in somebody's face. That's par for the course.
Yeah, it's just his tone of being, but not in a bad way.
In a bad way, but just in your face.
It's weird that there's all of us here, we're all bullies of different sorts. You know, we're going to talk about that a little later because we got some stories on the bullying. But he just handed me this. This is a new boss on Liberal Nets. Clutch Larson hits me with yesterday. I'm reading something, I say envoy instead of envoy. That's a simple mistake, isn't it? I thought it was poetic license in the headlines, you know?
Wait a minute. What? You didn't get 20 lashes or anything for that?
No, but he's accusing me of saying something to him before that, whereas I'm an angel, and I never...
Never.
Would I take a shot at anybody? I mean, come on. What does it say, Riley? Let's see. From day one, Liberal Talk Network, Air America, has worked to erase the image of liberals as humorless men and women who pontificate on the merits of title of what? And aid to developing nations. What is that? Title IX.
Title IX.
And aid to developing nations. On the merits. What is Title IX? Am I stupid?
Title IX, I think, is an education title, isn't it? I don't know.
Equal rights for women. That's what it is. That's what Jonathan Larson just told me.
Really?
You should definitely know that. See, so I guess I'm not a standard liberal. I didn't know it by that name. God, I feel stupid.
No, I didn't know it by that. Well, you know, David Hinckley, who writes for the Daily News. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Wait a minute.
No. Title IX is an education amendment.
Oh.
Education Amendment of 1972?
Thank God for the computer, right? That's why the Air America lineup heard locally on WLIB is sprinkled with hosts like Mark Maron, Al Franken, and Janine Garofalo. And then it's got a picture of Danny Goldberg, the new boss. But they mentioned my name first, I think, is why Jonathan gave this to me. Not that that kind of stuff is important to me, because I'm above that. You know what I mean? I'm not petty. You know, this kind of stuff doesn't bother me. You know, I just know that we're here doing a good job, you know, representing our show, representing the network, representing the people that like us and don't like us but still listen. Do you know what I'm talking about,
yes,
right?
Yes, I understand exactly what
you're talking about. So moving into some of the topics for today, we've got Max Cleland. This is a deep tease, as they call it in the business, because he's going to come up in like the third hour. But he's worth waiting for, or at least checking back in with us once you get to work. Or, you know what? Don't stop listening. Listen to us. We get some really interesting emails from people who can't get us on their radio where they live. Mm-hmm. So there's some guy that actually, you know, he hooks up a computer that he has to have the speakers that they apparently raise on some sort of dumbwaiter up to their bedroom. Very encouraging emails, the lengths that people will go to listen to us. We are going to talk about bullies in a little while because they're – there's apparently a school that is, you know, being developed, or there's school programs that are being developed, and whole schools.
A charter school, yeah.
A charter school where kids who are victims of bullying, which is a pretty broad spectrum of different types of kids, are going to, you know, be able to go to school with none of a specific type of bullying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that bullies will eventually evolve in any sort of situation. Do you know what I mean? But they're not going to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That even if you have a broad spectrum of victim children, or whatever you want to call them, of kids who are fragile for whatever reason in the context of regular high school, that some sort of bully pecking order will occur within that system too. But I think they're good in terms of, you know, getting them away from the brutality, the psychological brutality of jocks and the intolerant. Am I being too, you know?
No, we ought to be clear. Not all bullies are jocks.
No, I'm a bully, and I have been in my life. I mean, I try not to be, but, you know, when I think of high school and the type of bullying that went on and the type of intolerance that goes on, I think we can sort of stereotypically say there is a certain type of person. And now am I being bullying and judgmental by saying that? That there's a certain type?
Well,
all I know, Riley, is I'm 41 years old.
Yeah.
If I see a kid with a letter jacket on, part of me goes, oh, no, be cool. Still. You know, I think I've said
even
that
after all this time?
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. I mean, that kid's not thinking of hurting me. He's probably saying, why is the old guy looking at me funny? You know what I mean? And then he's probably saying, that guy's probably a queer. That's why he's looking at me like that.
Am no!
Am I projecting again?
Yeah.
I am?
Yeah.
Why do you say that, Kayla? What, you don't think that's possible? That maybe that I might be right in one case? One case out of 10, maybe?
All right, it's possible, but you're pretty much projecting.
All right, so it's a broad stroke. You say I'm painting with a too broad a brush. All right, you know
yeah.
what? Not an issue. You know, here's what we need to talk about is why Mark Riley, why did these Democrats vote for Clotcher? Okay? Why did these Democrats refuse to filibuster the bankruptcy bill that's going through? Why?
Yes.
You ready? Here they are. Biden, Carper, Nelson, Johnson, Byrd.
All right, the first four.
Yeah.
Credit cards.
Yeah. Okay, right, because
Two are from Delaware, and one each from Nebraska
South Dakota,
all of which are credit card hubs.
I can't, right, so they're credit card hubs. They're credit card hubs, so they're the credit card hubs. Is that what you're saying? That Joe Biden, Tom Carper, Ben Nelson, Tim Johnson are in credit card hubs, which makes them credit card company hosts.
Well, you could say that.
You're much more forgiving, and you can because you are a more mature, wise person when it comes to the nature of politics. I can't quite understand why they had to bend over.
Well, because they might face a challenge in their home states if they don't.
So they're worried that the credit card companies will stop pimping them and go to another hub from a different
right.
party.
Someone who's
or even
willing.
From the same party.
Yes, who's willing
to bend over.
Yes.
That's what they expect.
Yes.
So the people of the particular states that they live in is not really important. Their constituency is not important because the constituency doesn't have the real power to bend them over like money does.
Well, see, the constituents, the people in Delaware, some people in Delaware will tell you that they make a lot of money from the credit card companies and from, you know, the business and corporation rules that they have there, which are among the most relaxed in the country.
All right, well, let's talk about Herb Kohl in Wisconsin.
That's an interesting
Let's
one.
Talk about Joe Lieberman. Well, that's understandable. He's a Republican.
Mary
let's
Landrieu, talk, didn't she?
Mary work? Landrieu, yes,
yeah, from
Louisiana.
Louisiana.
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. But she was one of those people that our man Sam Rosenfeld said would probably vote in favor vote in favor of not having, let me see. Oh, and vote in favor of cloture.
Right. That's what we're talking about. So we've got Senator Blanche Lincoln.
Yes.
We've got Senator Bill Nelson, Senator Mark Pryor, Senator Ken Salazar of Colorado. And he's like,
Now, interestingly enough, some of those same people, including Salazar, voted in favor of Chuck Schumer's abortion.
All right, so they tried to stop it that way, but then when they saw the jig was up, they said, all right. You know, but I just, maybe this is state politics stuff. Maybe this is stuff that, maybe there's bankruptcy issues within their state, but they still, you know, there's 14 of them here. So 1, 2, 3,
yeah,
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 2, 4, I can't count them. But there's enough of them for me to be, you know, aggravated and maybe naive in saying this was one of those opportunities where they could have all gotten together and at least stood up, you know, on the same side of the aisle, all of them, against this thing.
Well, we'll see what happens now when the bill comes up on the floor, and which Democrats will, in the end, vote for the bill itself.
Right. Well, there's pretty much, they're saying that that's going to happen, right? There's...
Well, they say it's going to pass, and it'll probably pass rather easily. But I don't know which of these senators. There may be some senators who voted for cloture who will end up voting against the bill anyway.
Hey,
that's possible.
Right. So let's come back and talk about exactly again. We talked about it almost all day yesterday. But let's revisit what this bankruptcy bill means to regular people and what it means or it means not to wealthy people. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
This is to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Is that a little spoon, man? 21 past the hour, Air America Radio. It's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
What kind of idiot is Chris Cornell to turn his back on this band to go sing for that other outfit? You got to be nuts. Right at the peak of what they were going to be, Soundgarden, a monster band, a great hard rock band. They could have been seminal. Chris is like, let's break up. We're going to break up the band. What an idiot. For Rage Against the Machine, what an idiot. Unbelievable. Listen to that guy play guitar. Rage Against the Machine, you can't even tell it's a guitar. That guy plays through so much noise machines. All right, man. So I'm going to be performing at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco on Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd. You can go to morningsedition.com to check out information. It'll link you to something that'll get you tickets. The entire extended Milfington family is on vacation. But we're letting you vote for your favorite Milfington comedy bits at morningsedition.com, and we're playing the winners. Today's War on Brains. So we'll hear the winner of that today. We're having all kinds of little contests on morningsedition.com.
Uh-oh.
A thinly veiled attempt to see if you like us. As is anything that asks you to do anything online. What do you think? They don't care what you think. They're just trying to count your head. But we're not actually doing that. We like our audience. And we've got nothing but support and fun gift packages. Yeah, and we don't even have that. We can't even count who comes on our website. It's ridiculous. You know what I mean? We just want to have a good show. So do that. And, okay, now we're getting into the bankruptcy thing. If people don't remember, you know, I don't like this excuse, Riley. This idea that, first of all, when they say that the reason they're passing this legislation, the reason people support it is it's going to reckon with abuses to bankruptcy, that people are, you know, taking advantage of it. Now, first of all, 9 out of 10 bankruptcies occur because of health costs, loss of employment, or divorce, right? And the other thing is that they you can't blame the victims here. And they say, well, people have a choice, you know, fiscal responsibility, social responsibility. Dude, if you get something in your mailbox every day, at least one thing that says, how about some free money? You need a little free money right now? I mean, I think they're asking a little too much. They underestimate, not the credit card companies, but critics of people, of people who say that that victims are responsible for victimness. Look, you know, if you are, you know, they have perfected predatory lending. They have perfected advertising to a point where they're screwing with our heads on a very deep level, and somebody has to take some responsibility for that side of it.
Well, see, here's the thing, Mark. Where people really have to start taking responsibility is for creating the crisis that this bill is supposedly trying to address. Now, let's get our heads around some numbers here. As you just pointed out, 9 out of 10 people who declare bankruptcy declare it for emergency reasons, medical reasons, you know, loss of employment, that sort of thing. That is not something that is disputed by the people who've been lobbying for the bill. Now, think about this for a minute. The American Bankruptcy Institute, which is a nonpartisan organization, says that 3% of those who file Chapter 7, which is the one that wipes your debts clean, could afford to repay a portion of their debt under Chapter 13. 3%. Lobbyists for the bill say that figure is 10%. All right, so there's a variation there between 3 and 10%. That means 90% of what you're dealing with, according to the people who are promoting the legislation, 90% are people who cannot afford
to repay their loan.
Yeah, so what happens to those people? Well,
yes.
They're
screwed is what happens
exactly.
to those people.
Exactly. As Warren Buffett says, we're creating a sharecropper society. You know, as Paul Krugman says, it's a debt peonage society. But what really happens to them, ultimately, they fall through the cracks. They die. They go broke. They can't get their medicine. They shoot themselves in the mouth. That's what happens to these people because there's no other alternatives for them. And what about the wealthy? Is there any punishment for them? They get to hide their money. They can hide their money in Alaska, Delaware, Nevada, Rhode Island, Utah. Are they going to take down corporations with bankruptcy? No, they just file what, Chapter 13?
No, they file Chapter 11.
And what happens in the WorldCom, what's his name, Ebers? You know, he gets to, you know, go to one of his four houses and sit in his pool and go, what am I going to do next? I don't have to worry. I have like $300 million or however much they have. What about those guys? They don't get to pay? Why don't we have those guys pay the people that can't afford to do anything? Spread the wealth out. Oh, man, I'm talking like a commie.
Well, see, when it comes to, remember that they had an amendment that would have closed the loophole, that asset protection trust, that would have closed the loophole that wealthy people used to shield their money during bankruptcy proceedings. That amendment was shot down.
This is an administration, a government that favors corporations over individuals at all times. It's an adapt-or-die policy. And you know what? It seems to me that in the next few years, you know, certainly after this administration cuts and runs and leaves this country in shambles economically, that we're going to see a surge of homelessness, suicide, destitution, drug addiction like we've never seen before. I don't mean to be a prophet of doom because I'm optimistic, all right? But, you know, that scenario is a perfect scenario for the people, the real people, the marginalized, the people who need help, the people who are unrepresented in this country to rally behind a candidate of some sort, or else Jesus is going to come back.
Well, you know, when you look at the numbers here, Mark, it's very clear and very simple. Under the estimates that I just gave, 3% to 10%, that means 30,000 to 100,000 people every year will be forced to repay a portion or all of their debt. Now,
by what, taking out a loan?
Well, that's what, what they're saying is, well, these people can afford to do it because their income is higher than the median income of the state they live in. The problem is, what happens if they got divorce payments? What if they got other payments that make it so that their income really isn't what it seems on paper in terms of the gross income? They're gonna have to repay this portion of their bankruptcy at the same time. This is the kind of stuff that drives people to do things.
Well, look, you know, and it's still time to write your senators. We'll give you a list of the Democrats that have been turned out by this legislation. Also, I'm not a communist. I'm an American. They have the same laws that apply to rich and poor is the way it should be. Right, Riley?
Absolutely.
All right, we'll be back in a second. Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Weather.
Truly, this is the last great Stones album. I'm all about the music this morning. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Me too.
On Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. The credit card industry already makes $30 billion a year. This legislation would boost their profits by 5%. So that's what, $1.5 billion? Wow, they probably need that. I feel bad for those credit card companies.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean.
Me too.
It hurts me that they would not, that they would be shorted out of anything. You know, that really hurts my feelings.
Every nickel they need to get.
I'm glad that this administration takes care of the corporations because we don't want them to suffer, do we? Yes. All right, here we go. As you probably know, President Clinton is heading back to the hospital for another heart procedure. I hope he does okay. What is it? A speedy recovery?
Yes.
But first, he's going to Florida to raise money for tsunami victims. And, Ramon showed up today with his big shorts, cargo shorts, and his Tahiti what do you call that? Safari? What is that shirt? The Hawaiian shirt.
Hawaiian tourist shirt.
6 a.m. Clinton's bomb pilot. 6 a.m. Wake up. Get to work. My legacy won't polish itself. 8 a.m. Play golf in Florida with Bush Sr. to raise money for tsunami victims. Listen patiently to his complaints about W. Again, preaching to the choir, buddy. 10 a.m. Since each donor is paying $30,000 just to play golf with us, be sure to get their email addresses. Hillary could hit them up for that thing in 4 years we're not talking about yet. Yeah, Hillary could hit them up. Yeah, I know what that is. 12:30 p.m. lunch. Stick to diet. Green salad and Cialis. Cialis. Cialis?
Cialis.
Cialis.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff that does the thing. 2 p.m., prepare to go to the hospital for heart procedure. Remember, don't make any rude jokes about removing my fluids.
Ooh.
Wow. 4 p.m., work on volume 2 of memoirs. Refined story about how I gave up the bed on the plane to Bush Sr. and then slept on the floor. That's going to be such a good scene in the movie. At 10 p.m., call Hillary. Play the sympathy card about the heart surgery thing. Want to stay on the short list for VP slot. The short list. Short list. All right, dude. So let's get back into this. Oh, hot off the press. That's right. Hot off the press, my friends. Although the personal life of ordinary citizens was under strict control in most fascist countries, the ability of large corporations to operate in relative freedom was not compromised. The ruling elite saw the corporate structure as a way to not only ensure military production, but also as an additional means of social control. Members of the economic elite were often pampered by political elite to ensure a continued mutuality of interest, especially in the repression of have-not citizens. And now you have the banking industry buying politicians to buy laws that would support their profits, you know, over the people of this country. As you said, Riley, if 100,000 of those people that are going to declare bankruptcy and now have to pay the credit card companies on their debt, the profit is apparently about $1.5 billion, if not
more. $5 billion. Now, how much of that profit, how much of that money that they're going to, you know, suck out of the wallets of consumers that they, by the way, you know, reached out and put the credit cards in their wallets in the first place, but we'll leave that aside for now. But how much of that is actual debt versus interest on debt and late fees because people couldn't pay the debt? That's the question I have. What are the percentages here so that people know exactly how much of this windfall that the credit card companies are going to get? Now, they won't say it's a windfall. They will tell you, well, you know, I mean, this is what we're owed. This is not a windfall to the industry. This is money that we're collecting that is due us that these people can afford to pay. And damn it, they should pay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how they approach this thing. And that's cool. But what maybe it's not cool. But what I think troubles me about this more than anything else, Mark, and I don't want to get too far afield here, is that this is going to be seen as a major victory for this donkey we got in the White House. And when you combine that with his whole Middle East thing, which I told you all about last week, that he was going to start taking credit for that, too. There are articles in the paper, you know, Bush, Middle East. So now suddenly he's got a twofer.
Never take the blame, always take the credit for other people's work, for things that happen spontaneously or just through momentum. Always take the credit, never take blame. Disperse blame.
Yeah, disperse blame. Disperse it onto the backs of middle-class consumers while you let the wealthy skate.
That's right. How long is it going to take the middle class to realize they're poor?
Yeah. And by the way, for working people, working poor people, to realize exactly how this system screws them on a daily basis. Because and we were talking about this before, the states are feeling the brunt of federal cutbacks. They are the ones that are ending up having to make the difference. It means increased transit fares in places like New York. It means decreased farm subsidies out in the Midwest. It means a whole rejiggering, God help me, I use that word, in the way the country runs.
Adapt or die.
Exactly.
So let's talk about these Democratic senators. Look, you know, obviously this is a done deal. The jig is up. It's going through. It, you know, it's got the votes it needs. But it doesn't mean you can't write your senator and say, what are you thinking? You know, because at some point these people got to behave in concert with each other to make us at least feel like we have some sort of unified Democratic organization up there, which is ridiculous in and of itself. We're going to have to wait for that, apparently. But, you know, Joe Biden, Tom Carper, Ben Nelson, and Tim Johnson, obviously, they're lost to us, okay? They are lost to us because they are on the tip of the credit card corporations because their states dictate that, and the credit card corporations dictate their behavior because they're the ones with the money. And I'm not saying forgive them, by no means forgive them, even though I like Joe Biden. It's a shame that, you know, I have to see him like this, you know, all crying and, you know, holding it, you know, with that sad face where he's like buckling up his pants saying, I'm sorry. It wasn't my fault. I'm sorry.
As Walter Cronkite used to say, that's the way it is.
Right. But Robert Byrd, what the hell is that? What has that guy got to lose? Why is he not on board with this? He's 90. What is he? 100? What is he? 120? How old is that guy?
Does he own a credit card company or something?
I don't know. It's West Virginia. You know, Kent Conrad.
It's West Virginia.
I don't know.
In other words, it's West Virginia. Maybe he does own a credit card.
I don't know. But, I mean, I'm just saying, like, these are outspoken people, and maybe I don't understand the nuances of politics, but let's get on board here.
We see more discipline in the Republican ranks on this and other legislation than we do on the Democratic side, and that is unnerving. It is irritating. It makes me angry,
Let me give you the rest of these. Mary Landrieu.
Yep.
Joe Lieberman, Blanche Lincoln, Bill Nelson, Mark Pryor, Ken Salazar, Debbie Stabenow. If these are your people, you know, just shoot them an email. You know, say, you know, what up? You know, what is going, what the are you thinking? You know, trying to, you know, help us out here so we can have a little faith at least.
Well, I mean, look, it may well be that these folks will come back to the fold on other issues. They all promised to go after the UN guy, Bolton.
Yeah.
I keep thinking Officer Joe Bolton. Those of you who've been around for a while in New York, you know who I'm talking about. But, yeah, Bolton, they're supposed to be tough on him. They're going to try and stick up his confirmation. My guess is they won't be able to either. And part of what we, I think, really do have to look at in terms of the Democratic Party, Mark, is where are you going to take the stand? Where are you where and when are you going to articulate a vision that is different? Don't just stand up and say, well, we're going to fight on this and we're going to fight on that and then lose and say, oh, we fought. That's cool. But when are you going to articulate a vision that will help make the American people and give the American people the ammunition they need to stand up and say, wait a minute, we don't like the direction that the country's going in and we're going to stop it?
Well, clearly they're going to have to wait until, you know, half or 75 to 80% of the middle class is broke and destitute. And, you know, the have-nots become so many.
Yeah,
they're going to be undeniably unified. You know, I hope that happens again.
Oh man, that'll be another depression, man.
That's all right. Let's bring it on. You know, what else? You know, what else? How else is
you don't want to? You don't want to live in America with 25% unemployment. Trust me, you really don't.
Okay, I'm sorry I said that. Well, here's what's happening. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is trying to stand up to the bullies by accusing them of abusing their power through parliamentary tactics designed to suppress dissent. And this is the thing, is that, you know, you really have a bully Congress. You know, I mean, you know, you get Tom DeLay, you get all these cats who have no decorum, no class, and they don't care. And there's a whole new generation of politicians, certainly on their side, that has no context of history, no context for politeness in terms of, you know, being dignified or noble in terms of politics, which I don't know if it ever existed. But Pelosi, not unlike, I guess, Gingrich did when he came in with the Democrats, is accusing the Republicans of basically being legislative bullies and not actually letting government engage in the way it's supposed to engage.
I'm scared that the Democrats in Congress are waiting for the Republicans to overreach, to go too far with something that they're proposing. I'm afraid right now, Mark, that the Republicans have learned the hard lessons of the Gingrich era and several eras when Republicans dominated the political landscape prior to Newt Gingrich, where they did overreach. The American people reacted to the whole shutting down of government in the mid-1990s.
Right.
That was typical of the overreaching. Well, it doesn't seem like they're prepared to make that kind of mistake again. What they're doing is getting their legislative ducks in a row. They are operating, I have to say it, with frightening discipline to get this agenda into law.
Yeah, and the Pelosi's report apparently is going to, I quote, she's accusing them of severely restricting and sometimes totally blocking the minority's ability to debate or amend bills. You know, and, you know, I hope that does something. I doubt it will because of what you're saying, Riley, is that, you know, the sort of momentum that they have and the relentless with how relentless they are is going to do a lot of damage to this country.
Well, they got class action. They got bankruptcy. You know what's next on the agenda? And it's not necessarily Social Security. It's the court system. The judicial nominees that are going to go through this Congress are going to be the next battleground. That's where Chuck Schumer and that's where some of these other folks who have been able to block some of Bush's judicial nominees during his first term, that's where they're going to have to make their stand. Because the Republicans have gained enough seats in the Senate, particularly, to push some of these people through. And, of course, the prize that everybody has their eye on is the Supreme Court. And Rehnquist ain't getting any healthier.
No, that's for sure. And also the restricting victims' rights legislation is going to be another big thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because they're not done with that yet either.
Yeah, so when we come back, let's talk about bullies. And we have the liberal agenda, and we're going to talk a little bit about young bullies. It's 45 past the hour on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Have it. feels good to be a gangster.
49 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly on Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Kalo Koskoho, that sounds like music you go out to. That sounds like music sort of like, all right, we'll be back in a second.
You know what? Let me do my job. I'll let you do your job, and we'll call it a day.
Ooh.
Yeah, but you know what the problem with that is, Kalo? Is that...
it's a liberal agenda.
What's that?
Is that we're all working together. I'm not saying anything like this song. I'm going to cry. That's what I'm going to do. Here's a liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. One, bribe the doctors who are draining Bill Clinton's chest for some of the fluid and begin cloning the 53rd president of the United States of America. Two, now that the White House is credentialing bloggers, push to get credentials for people who stand around the water cooler saying what a jerk George Bush is. Get him some credentials. Three, urge a boycott of the Vin Diesel film The Pacifier. There's nothing politically incorrect about it, but God, what a crappy idea for a movie. Am I wrong? Four, in honor of Irish American Heritage Month, boycott those whose actions are destroying Irish culture, the British, the Catholic Church, and the creator of Riverdance. Five, today's phrase. Slip into conversation, okay? John R. Bolton belongs at the United Nations as much as Michael Bolton belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Wake up, sheeple. They're ruining the last hope for world peace and classic R&B. Hey, Chris. I threw a wad of paper at you. How do you like that?
Good job, bully.
I'm the bully just because I make a little comment about... You know what? I don't know if I am the bully.
Yeah. Did I throw paper at you, Billy?
Who called me fat for 3 days going? 3 or 4 days going? Who's trying to muscle me?
Who's calling me fat?
You are.
I was retaliating, my friend.
You are fat, though. I'm not fat. What, guy can't be objective?
I see.
Do you think I should? You want to be in a special school with fat people? How about a special
that
camp?
That sounds actually pretty good. You
want to go to fat camp this summer? That's the conversation we're going to have. Because I am, Riley, a relatively sensitive person, actually, which is what makes people reactive kind of bullying types. Is their own sensitivity. Now, I'm reading about this school in Milwaukee, the Alliance School. It's a charter high school for students that feel vulnerable or victimized by other people, homosexual students, gay students. They're two different classes, homosexual students and gay students.
And gay students.
No, gay students, you know, people who are different either, you know, the
goths, people that dress funny.
Yeah, but those, that might just be a phase. I mean, you know, there are certain people that just attract, they're bully magnets. You know who they are. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And do they belong, should they have their own school? Some people are bullied for their intelligence. Some people are bullied because of their weight, of the way they wear their clothes or their hair or their skin. You know, I mean, a lot of that stuff happens in any sort of high school. But the question is here is that should the vulnerable, you know, in terms of the way the mediocre sort of mainstream society characterizes these vulnerable people, and they always, you know, it's predictable who they are.
Oh, yeah, it is predictable. And I think that one of the things that this particular school, the Alliance Charter School out in Milwaukee, is looking to do is blunt the notion that these schools would only be created, for example, for gay students, because gay students obviously are harassed. They are bullied in great numbers in schools all over America.
But, you know, Pashman's got a different thought on this, but, you know, right, they're trying to blunt the gay school, and I don't even think that the gay school is such a bad idea. Think of what, you know... I don't want to generalize, but gay culture and gay people have generated some great momentum in the arts and in so much culture in this country and I guess everywhere that I just think that imagine what could come out of a school where they had a sort of freedom not to be persecuted on a day to day basis just because of what people think of them, what bullies think of them, how they're stereotyped.
Well, ultimately, Mark, the question here is whether or not these kids will get a better education in this environment than they will in a regular environment. And see, that's where you get the problem, because there are going to be people who will make the argument. I'm not making this argument. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. But there are people who make the argument, well, if you set up a separate school for bullies, why not set up a separate school for kids from bad homes?
Or
a school for kids whose parents who are from single-parent families.
They do have those schools for kids from bad homes. They're called jails.
See?
Yeah, but the thing is, is that, you know, Pashman thinks it differently. You're right. That how specialized do they all get? That's one argument.
Yeah.
But Pashman says, he's sitting right here, is that, like, I am finding myself, as we discuss this, to be more in support of this type of situation, because I know that a pecking order will unfold within, you know, the victim schools. All right? I know that a pecking order, there will be different types of bullies, but just to not have to deal with the sort of, you know, monkey-minded, narrow, you know, sort of stereotyping crap that someone has to deal with in high school, it scars people permanently, but you think differently.
Well, Mark, my point is that there are bullies everywhere. As I get a little older, I see that the real world isn't all that different from the playground.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in your life, you need to learn how to deal with people that are going to try to bully you, that are going to try to push you around for mm-hmm. whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone out there has faced a bully at some point in their lives, many people, multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't develop that ability at some point in your growing up time, if you don't have to face it, then when you get out into the real world, you're not going to be able to deal with it either. You're right that bullies will always exist.
But I think that's crazy. I think what you're providing these people with, why don't we ask Matthew Shepard? All right, you know what he would think of an idea like this. You know what I mean? The thing is, I don't mean to be a buzzkill, but the truth of the matter is that by the time a kid is 15 and going into high school, I mean, believe me, he's had to deal with enough crap. I mean, those tools are already well honed. Why shouldn't a kid be able to go to high school? They're going to find their own groups within high schools anyways. But wouldn't it be nice to be able to go where you really don't have to deal with, there's a certain amount of tolerance initiated within the school that you don't have to deal, especially with the way the mainstream sort of, you know, stereotyping goes on now, to have the freedom to at least have 4 years that are productive, and you have to develop this weird callus and wince whenever, you know, a certain type of person walks by you.
I will grant you that there are certain very extreme examples of people out there who have been bullied and picked on to the point of causing permanent damage. But I think that those are very much a very small minority of people. Most people deal with a reasonable amount of, well, maybe reasonable, not the right word, but a normal amount of bullying as part of their growing up. I hate to say it, but you know what? It builds character.
Yeah, well, that's stupid.
I don't think...
No, I'll tell you where the problem here is. And that is, how do people respond to the bullying? Because some people respond to bullying or being isolated or being harassed or whatever with violence.
And
we've
bullying.
Seen that happen.
Let's take some calls at 866-303-2270. What do you think?
Remember, the kids in Columbine were supposed to have been bullied kids.
Yeah, and you know, what do you think of that, Dan? What do you think? Huh? Huh? what do you think of that, Dan? All right, so 866-303-2270 is the number. What do you think? Do you think schools for people that are vulnerable to social stereotyping and bullying is a good idea? Or do you think, like Dan thinks, that, hey, man, it makes you tough? We want to know what you think. What, Dan? What?
I just don't agree. I think that if you put kids in a bully-free school, it's like raising animals in captivity. Once you send them out into the wild, they're going to get their asses kicked.
But people like looking at them.
And they're fun to pet.
When we come back as well in our next hour, Dan Rather's last day, we'll talk to somebody who knew him well, Tom Jarrell of ABC News, here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Are you getting... Six past the hour, it's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Dan Pashman is here. So are all you out there, philosopher kings and queens, geniuses, working class heroes, progressive utopians. We're talking about Alliance School, a charter high school that will focus on students who feel discriminated against or bullied. We're taking calls. We've already got them lined up. We don't have a long segment. We're going to blast through these and get your opinions and address them from here in the studio, which is where we are. Why am I saying that? Hey, Larry in Miami, how are you? What's your opinion?
Hey, Larry.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys?
Good.
I'm the same man who's actually really opposed to charter school.
Why?
And the reason is basically socialization. The fact of the matter is that, as one of your guests already said, we need to learn to live with each other.
Okay.
And the problem is the bullies. The problem is not the people who are getting victimized. And the longer we let them stay in the victim role, the longer that they're going to continue to be victims.
Thank you for your call,
Larry. All right,
Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
It's an interesting thing, but see, I understand that, you know, but I don't think that victims are moving on their own. They're not. I don't think they're being characterized as being put into camps. I think that the people that want to live in a separate reality, not a separate reality, but in a place that's safer for them and more tolerant is not, you know, I don't think you can get rid of bullies. Yeah, I just don't buy it, and I don't think that's even an issue to me because they're always going to be there.
But I think you're proving my point then, Mark, and that caller's point, which is that at some point you need to learn to deal with bullies.
Yeah, but they're going to live with them. They're going to live with them, but that doesn't mean in their formative years that they have to be taught some stupid lesson in survival in high school so that, you know what, so that what do you think is going to happen to a 15-year-old who comes out of 4 years of high school that where they had the freedom to do what the hell they want, they're going to all of a sudden enter the real world and go, oh, no, I can't work here.
Well, you're right that those are formative years, and in those formative years you need to learn how to deal with those kinds of people.
And you're going to deal with them. You're going to go out. You're going to go out and do things in the world. I don't know. I just think I could have gotten so much more done in certain areas if I wasn't bullied. I think so, personally. And I think that anybody who's ever been bullied in their life, if they really look back on it, yeah, they might have calluses, they might be tougher, but they could have got a lot more done without the obstacle of some moron standing in their way with some stupid idea of them. Anyways, Eric in Connecticut. Eric, what's on your mind?
I am a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I've treated many kids who have been bullied, so I'm in favor of a charter school because what I find, even in very affluent areas, is that the schools minimize the effects of being bullied, and they don't provide the support a child needs. So I've treated kids with post-traumatic stress disorder. What you're describing as callous and hardened is actually numb and avoidant, and these are symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. I've treated kids who have been suicidal, who have brought violent items to school, and who have really resorted to dropping out of school at times.
Right. Numb and what was the other? Numb and detached, did you say?
Numbing, avoidance, and re-experiencing, like flashbacks.
Yeah, so is that the way you want, Dan, is that how people should enter the world? Thank you for your call.
Thanks for the call.
Numb and avoiding, is that strength?
I think that those are the most extreme examples.
That's crazy.
I mean, where do you draw the line of what is normal, a normal part of growing up? I mean, do you want everyone? People need to learn to live together and grow up together and deal with different kinds of people.
They
at
will.
Some point,
they
need
will.
To be socialized.
They will. They're going to learn to do that in all situations. But dealing with all right.
Not if they spend their formative years in a bubble.
Steve, what's up, Steve?
Hey, Steve.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
All right.
Listen, I'm a public school teacher from Asheville, North Carolina. I'm a drama teacher. So the kids that get bullied, those are my kids. I was one of those kids growing up. And if we don't fix what's wrong in the public system, instead of organizing our own little sort of compounds and militia groups and forming our own little charter schools, we're never going to fix our public system.
A militia theater group?
The charter schools are almost like the separatist militia groups. Like, this community doesn't like what the public school is doing, so they'll separate off into their own little utopian camp, and you have to start wondering, you know, what kind of education are the kids getting for parents who are barely scraping funding out to start these charter schools?
Okay.
I said we fix the environment, we stop raising the little monsters that terrorize my kids as a drama teacher, and, you know, we sort of fix the problem from the inside rather than just breaking it into a bunch of smaller problems.
Good idea. Thanks a lot.
That's an interesting point, but remember that charter schools, from a technical standpoint, are public schools. They are paid for with public money. It's not the same as vouchers where they give the parents money and the parents can put their kids in a parochial school. A charter school is, by definition, a public school.
Right. One more quick call. Greg in Florida. Greg?
Yeah, how you doing, guys?
Good.
All right.
What's on your mind?
If you take the kids that are getting picked on and put them in a school, special school, then one of the picked on kids is going to become a bully. It's human nature.
That's right.
What would you rather, get chased around by some athlete or get chased around by some kid with a tuba?
Hey, wait a minute. What's wrong with tubas, pal?
That's more damaging to your psyche.
Good point, Greg.
But
that's my point as well, is that you're not going to avoid them learning how to deal with something. It's just going to be in a more creative environment. I'm sure that, you know, I'd rather a tuba. You know what I mean?
Then what's the point of the school?
Or a flute, maybe.
I don't want to get
what's the point of the school? It's not some kid hitting me in the back of the head or throwing a football in my face, calling me a wuss. You know, it's some guy going, bah, 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 bah. It's annoying, but God bless him for expressing himself.
But remember that at the root of bullying is physical superiority. That's what bullies try and reinforce. If somebody's bigger than you and stronger than you, you can't bully them unless they're morons.
No, I think that bullying is almost 90% psychological, myself.
It may be psychological, but at its root is the idea that I can whip your behind if I want.
I don't know. I think the root is controlling and manipulation. I don't think it's about kicking ass.
But if somebody's hitting you in the back of your head, what are they doing? They're getting physical with you.
That's if it's violent.
Well,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but
a lot of bullying turns out to be
Larson
in
bullies
it.
Me all the time, but he couldn't. I don't think he could.
You're gross.
I've not seen you throw a ball, man. You're kind of a spaz. I don't think you could do it.
You have not seen me throw a ball.
I saw you throw a piece of paper at Kalo.
I can play ball. We're going to talk to Tom Jarrell after this, a close friend and co-worker of Dan Rather, about Dan Rather's career, and also about the integrity of reporting in this world that we live in. 12 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Seventeen past the hour, Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. I think we solved some stuff about bullying. Maybe not, but I think one thing we can say is that it will always be with us. Our guest on the phone, I'm very excited about this. He was a correspondent on ABC News, the program 2020, for 20 years. He also covered the White House for ABC. He has known Dan Rather for some 50 years. They both worked in Texas at their beginnings together. Tom Jarrell is with us. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Mark and Mark.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. I want to talk, you know, right off the bat about Dan Rather. And, like, you know, I was just listening this morning to that interview that he did with then Vice President George Bush, and just his tenacity and, you know, his ability to get at the heart of a question. Why, you know, outside of that, why was he such a lightning rod for the right?
Well, I think because he was saying things in his reports that alarmed them, that disturbed them, that even if they usually were accurate and true, they didn't want to hear. He also, if you go back and check his career, he said and did things to the liberals on the left.
Sure.
And he even praised Republicans. He praised Ronald Reagan to the hilt and Libby Dole. He had a record of any newsman. If you're going to deal with issues, if you're going to deal with problems that face the public and the viewers, you are going to step on toes and have to challenge higher power. That's the nature of the beast of journalism, and he did it very, very well.
Yeah, it's amazing to listen to that, because I noticed that even when then Vice President George H.W. Bush was talking to him, that, you know, he mentioned CBS in almost a demonizing way. Do you feel that the Republicans have been gunning for CBS for years?
I think less than the senior Bush. I think senior Bush and Rather were just a couple of feisty Texans sort of duking it out in a macho way, and I wouldn't be surprised today if they met, they wouldn't be actually friendly with each other. I don't know that for sure, but I know the personalities of both. I've known both men personally. But I think the trends in recent times, in recent months, toward giving such great credit to bloggers, whoever they are, wherever they are, with no credence and no idea of whether you can believe them or not, but suddenly they're taking on a life and claiming credit for massive accomplishments, like, in fact, getting Rather knocked out of the anchor chair, which is absolutely absurd. That was done by the Washington Post in excellent reporting, looking into the documents, and that was the beginning of the end for CBS. It was not some blogger sitting on an internet with an anonymous name, who knows who they are and where they're going, but in fact, they're getting more attention. Also, there's a very well, smart, orchestrated effort on the part of conservatives and Republicans by and large to intimidate the press, intimidate the major press institutions like the Post, traditional liberal organizations, yes, but to intimidate them with their comments, with the planned attacks, with things like, and I'm very suspicious of this goofy guy who got into the White House and walked around for 2 years with press credentials.
Sure.
Something more was behind that, believe me. I don't know if it was the Republicans, but certainly that was the spirit behind what he was doing.
Yeah, you're talking about Jeff Gannon.
Yeah.
Now, Tom Jarrell, there are some people who say that Dan Rather's exit is more than just a network anchor leaving a chair, that it's symbolic of the end of network news primacy. Do you disagree with that?
I disagree with that completely. I don't think it's the end of network news primacy, because you have three television networks still that aren't hooked into cable, that broadcast to homes over the air and reach tens of millions of more people than any other outlets are able to do. Plus, you have there's a combination that's essential. One is you've got to have both a strong entertainment leg of a network to have viewers and to have the strength of a network. Plus, you have to have a strong news division. If you just have a news division, then you simply can't reach the numbers of people that you need to. That's unique, then, with ABC, CBS, NBC, and now Fox, of course, is part of the mix.
Now,
Network news is going to continue to be powerful. There certainly are challenges and changes.
But now when I watch Dan Rather in his interview style and his reporting style, I got to tell you, Tom Jarrell, I don't see much of that today. I see a lot of reporters who are frightened for whatever reason. Either they're looking out for themselves, or they're being stifled by producers of actually doing the work of reporters, or they just don't know how to do it. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong at all. Reporters are not stupid. They see, and producers either, who really do a lot of the major work. Executives in news are intimidated. The intimidation comes from a couple of things. One, budgets have been cut back so that the money to be spent on investigative pieces is not there the way it once was. And two, lawyers have stepped in trying to avoid expensive lawsuits and are taking overriding control often of even down to the editorial decisions. And three, this is a major case. I mean, everyone knows of the Rather incident with the National Guard papers, but believe me, over the years, many a producer has gone through the ringer of producing investigative pieces and come out the other side saying, I'll never touch a story like that again. I'm going to do a personality profile rather than dig into this. So it takes a unique creature who's willing to lay their career on the line to dig into a investigative piece, whether it's a correspondent or a producer.
Mm-hmm. So, who's going to do that now? I mean, who's the next generation that might, it seems to me that what you're talking about could very easily be institutionalized, that no one would be willing to take the risk. Why the hell would they?
Well, why does anyone take the risk and go into Iraq carrying a gun or fly a jet plane? There are still people who see this as a calling.
That's good.
There's still a lot of career advancements and opportunities in the field of investigative. They're almost evangelical about it, many of them.
Do you see any young guns that you like?
Pardon?
Do you see any young guns that you like? Like some guy?
Brian Ross at ABC has an investigative unit that's a crack unit. They're smart. They have inside information. He is always on top of stuff. As far as investigative work, Bob Schieffer, of course, is going to be anchoring. But the Schieffer cut, those guys are fearless. They're not going to be intimidated by anything. They know what their role is in their careers. They are not going to fight to save their careers or be intimidated by the elements that are out there.
Now, Tom Jarrell, what do you make of some comments that have been made by people inside CBS that have been a little disparaging of Dan Rather? For example, the piece that was done by Ken Auletta in The New Yorker, where both Mike Wallace and Walter Cronkite were critical. And then Cronkite goes on CNN and says, and I'm quoting here, about Bob Schieffer, "I would like to have seen him there a long time ago." In other words, he should have replaced Rather back in the day.
I give zilch. Zero, no weight to any of those guys short of a strong smell of sour grapes. Cronkite left the anchor chair too soon. He realizes that now. He could have been around for a longer time had he been willing to go nose-to-nose and try to compete with Rather. He gave it up. Then he went off on the speed circuit to fatten his wallet. Then he sails off on his boat. 24 years later, he is now the pundit. Well, excuse me, but I think his license to punditry has expired. The same thing is true any time you have correspondence within a network. Everybody is reaching for the gold ring, the anchor chair.
Yeah.
It passed by Wallace. It passed by these other guys.
It's now
they see an opportunity to say, oh, well, you know, I'd like better anchors. Who assigned them as talent scouts for anchors? Why is anybody even asking them what they think about the anchor?
Oh, yeah.
That's
so hilarious to me, Tom Jarrell, that, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid in the sense that I never considered them just a bunch of catty, bitter guys.
No, they're smart guys.
I know.
They also are, interested in the future of CBS News. They want to have good anchors in there. And, Schieffer is an excellent choice. He's an interim guy, but watch it. Because if those ratings go up, he can be permanent just almost overnight. I've seen this before where they sort of send someone out to fill in and they'll watch the ratings every night and see how they're doing, who's watching, and so forth.
Are you going to watch them, Tom Jarrell?
Bob Schieffer, anytime.
Anytime?
See him handle the debates. He was the most cool, smart, detached, journalistically fair commentator on all the debates that went on this year. He's great.
Now, let me just ask you quickly, you know, how much does, you know, in terms of reporting style, how much does anyone's ego, you know, really play into it? Is that too vague a question? Because sometimes when I watch Rather, I realize that, you know, he has a lot invested in his personality is definitely there.
Well, his personality has been one that he has very carefully cultivated, and that is an on-the-scene, hard-driving, hard-questioning reporter.
Right.
That's his persona. It is also Dan Rather. I've known him since he was in Houston, Texas, doing local news.
But that's just the way he was.
For over many years, and that's his persona.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom Gerald. Really great to talk to you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
We'll hear a little clip of that interview with the Bush Sr. when he was Vice President, Dan Rather, after we come back.
Yeah, that was the interview heard around the world. Boy, that really set off
the spark. Did you hear that guy's voice? It was so well calibrated in my head. It was amazing.
Well, that's Tom Gerald. I mean, who are you going to mistake him for?
All right.
This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning's Edition. If you people only heard what we talk about during the break, we could be running a whole other morning show on another network.
Yeah, preferably satellite.
Oh, now I just know there's some of our listeners out there going, see, I told you. I told you.
Right, boys.
Here we go. Coming up next, I'm going to do the Dream Diary in a couple minutes, and you know, Riley and I are going to be taking some calls to do some dream interpretations, as we're wont to do on this day, Wednesday. We've been getting into it. It's kind of fun. I know. So if fun's going to bother you, maybe it's time to either sit there and seethe or, you know, do something else. So is your subconscious the heart at work? What's going on? Give us a call at 866-303-2270, and we'll interpret some dreams. I'm going to tell you mine in a minute. But first, you know, coming off of that great interview with Tom Gerald, just to hear his voice in my head was wild. I'm like, gee, I got to up my game. And all of a sudden, I'm engaging in, like, interview tactics that I know are right, but I, like, you know, like, resetting guests. Like, you know, well, Tom Gerald, tell me about, you know, and I'm like, wow, a former vice president at the time, I'm like, wow, look at me, Tom. Try to kiss up to Tom Gerald. Now, we have some footage here of Dan Rather interviewing the first President Bush
when he was vice president.
And this got a lot of attention because it's in 1988, and Rather was going for it, and he was getting it. All right, and let's hear it in two segments because he's going for it and he's getting it, and then he takes a hit. And then something changes. So let's hear the first segment.
Well, remember now, before we go to the segment, we should let people know that this was during the time that George W. Bush was running for the presidency in 1988.
And Dan Rather was trying to get his, you know, a sort of admission that he was hip to the
Iran-Contra.
Right. And also, you know, at the end of this, oh, well, I'll tell you what he's referring to when we come back in. Go ahead.
You repeatedly said in the meetings, you said in the meeting in which Secretary Shultz, in the most forceful way, register his objections. And then you said you never heard anybody register objections.
If it was the most forceful way, I've heard George Shultz be very, very forceful. And if I were there and he was very, very forceful at that meeting, I would have remembered that. I don't remember that.
Then how do you explain you can't remember it? The other people at the meeting say he was apoplectic.
I wasn't there at that point.
You weren't in the meeting?
I'm not suggesting. I'm just saying I don't remember it.
I don't want to be argumentative, Mr. Vice President.
You do, Dan. This is not a great night because I want to talk about why I want to be president, why those 41% of the people are supporting me.
And Mr. Vice President, these questions are
a whole career. It's not fair to judge my whole career by a rehash on Iran. How would you like it if I judge your career by those 7 minutes when you walked off the set in New York?
Well,
would you like that?
Mr. Vice President,
for you, but I don't have respect for what you're doing here tonight.
Wow. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? And Dan's like, oh, wow.
Now, this was what he was talking about there. Was in 1987, the year before, Dan Rather walked off the set of the CBS Evening News because it was being preempted by a tennis match, and there was somewhere between 6 and 7 minutes of dead air.
Yeah, he was in Miami, I think. Dan Rather was in Miami at the time. But the issue is that, like, he had him on the ropes, Riley. He had him. You know, George Bush Sr. couldn't say very enough times to stall long enough to get out of that very, 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 very wrong time. Yeah. Like, he had him on the ropes. He'd done it right. And then he did, then Bush made it personal. And coming back into it, Rather was a little, you know, stifled. And, you know, he threw a softball and then he'd lost his thread. But look, can we hear that part there, Chris?
Mr. Vice President, I think you'll agree that your qualification for president and what kind of leadership you'd bring to country, what kind of government you'd have, what kind of people you'd have around him is much more important than what you just referred to. I'd be happy to...
I want to be judged on the whole record.
Well,
and you're not...
And I'm trying to set the record straight.
You invited me to come here to talk about, I thought, the whole record.
I want you to talk about the record. You sat in a meeting with George Shultz.
Yes.
He got apoplectic when he found out that you and the president were being part of sending missiles to the Ayatollah of Iran. Can you explain how you were supposed to be the, you're an anti-terrorist expert. Iran was officially a terrorist state. You went around telling...
Explain that, Dan. I wanted those...
Mr. Buckley
out of there.
But you made us hypocrites in the face of the world. How could you sign on to such a policy?
Didn't it sound like, you know, it got personal? He was, you know, he was a little wounded. You know, his ego had gotten involved in it. But this is like I was trying to talk to Gerald about. You know, he is, you know, a fairly prideful guy, Rather, and that's part of what made him, you know, a great, interesting reporter.
Well, he was not ready for Bush to refer to that dead air thing. He wasn't ready for that.
Yeah.
He probably should have been ready for it, given where he was going, but I think he did get caught up in the emotion. Now, the thing that we also want to point out here is that this took place in early 1988, at the end, during the final year of the Ronald Reagan presidency. Dan Rather had not been severely critical of Ronald Reagan on any level prior to that. So it's not like this was part and parcel of a period, in other words, of his showing this, quote, liberal bias during the Reagan years. He never really showed that during the Reagan
years. But he did go, he went up against Nixon during Watergate.
He went up against Nixon during Watergate. But see, there was a difference then. Rather was not the anchor then.
Right.
By 1988, he was an anchor. He had been at the CBS Evening News for 7 years by then.
Yeah.
That made it a whole different thing when you have a network anchor going toe-to-toe like that, as opposed to a reporter who might be in a White House briefing or whatever the circumstances were when he had that thing with Nixon.
Yeah. Well, you know, he is calling it, this is his last day after 24 years.
24 years unprecedented.
As an anchor over at CBS, and head news anchor there, and... you know, it's definitely the passing of a generation to a certain degree, and it's you know, I'm not particularly hopeful. I'm not as hopeful as Tom Gerrell is, because, you know, he was, you know, citing Schiffer, and, you know, this guy is, you know,
oh, Bob Schiefer?
Schiefer's 68 years old. You know what
I
mean?
Well, Ronald Reagan was about that when he became president.
No, but where I we've talked to a couple cats here, a couple of reporters that, you know, have the juice. You know, I just hope that, you know, somebody, you know, starts to surface. It's like with anything else, like comedy or anything else. You're always happy, you know, well, not so much. I'm not happy when a great comic shows up and they're younger than me. But you know, I mean, I'm saying in other professions, it's nice to see a new guy come around.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Chris, you want to be the co-host for a little while? Let's see how happy that makes marriage.
All right, okay, well, radio hosting as well, I guess, is not something I want to see people better than me at now, too. But tennis, I don't play tennis. And news reporting, what?
Well,
that's fairly subjective.
Wait a minute, now we're drifting back into the discussion we were having.
All right, okay, so let's. I'm going to start with my dream, then we're going to hear one of yours, and we're going to do some interpretation. I'm at a meeting of the liberal bunnies in a cozy little living room, and we're all sipping cocoa, and everything is just adorable. One bunny in a hand-knit sweater and granny glasses says, "Mark, thanks for coming. We really love Air America. Okay, mostly Al, but we appreciate what you're trying to do, and even though It's self-indulgent and sophomoric boys club. And I say, well, thanks. Another bunny in a Peruvian peasant smock says, you have to stop supporting Hillary, okay? You have to stop supporting Hillary in 2008. I say, why? She's smart. She's passionate. What's the problem? Well, they all wrinkled their little bunny noses and started chiming in. Hillary can't win. I don't think she can stand another. I don't think we can stand another loss. And they all nod and say, can't win. Can't win. And she'll do more in the Senate. I mean, she's moved too much to the center. And they all nod and say, center, center. She's from New York. We can't have another East Coast intellectual. America's not ready for a woman. The red states need a president with a penis. They all nod and say, penis, penis. Then there's all that Clinton baggage. They all nod and say, penis, penis. I say, okay, I get it. No Hillary. So who do you want? And they just look away and clear their throats. And I say, huh, let's hear it. After 10 full seconds of silence, one of them says, you have a responsibility to talk about the issues. I mean, I like dreams and cats as much as anyone, but there are limits. They all nod and say, cats, cats. I woke up and my bed was filled with Ovaltine, a proud sponsor of Air America Radio. Now it's your turn. Give us a call, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270, and we'll give it a shot at analyzing your dream. We've got Carol listening in Highland Park. How are you, Carol? What do you got? You must be my neighbor.
I think I am.
Uh-oh.
So I haven't met you yet, though.
What's your dream?
This is an anxiety dream with a political twist that was so disturbing it just creeped me out.
Sounds like you already analyzed it.
I don't know. I haven't. I haven't thought about it since.
Okay.
My husband and I arrive at a theater complex.
Okay.
We participate in what we have, are thinking is a cold reading of a play by a woman we know, a graduate student. We get into the dark theater with just a couple of spots on the stage, and, of course, right away we realize that everybody else who's participating is in costume as Greek characters, ancient Greeks.
Togas and whatnot?
Pardon?
Togas and whatnot?
Yeah. And they all have memorized all their lines, and a group of actors go by speaking, you know, impressive lines, and I am freaking out, and I look over at the playwright, and I whisper to her, I need a script. So she gives me a script, and I'm looking, and there's a long list of characters, and I look back at her and whisper, okay, who am I?
Oh.
And this is the scary part. She says to my husband and myself, both in the same boat, Hude and Kuse.
Wow, Hude and Kuse.
Yeah. So, and I woke up at that point. It was just too much. I didn't know... Why them?
So the playwright said you and your husband were Uday and Kuse.
The Hussein brothers.
Yeah.
Well,
that's a pretty challenging dream. I'm going to have to take a break here to analyze it. Stay on the line, Carol, and we'll come back with an interpretation.
Oh, wow.
All right, we'll be back with Carol's dream interpretation after this. You're listening to Air America Radio. 866-303-2270 is our number if you've got a dream.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Having trouble...
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're on the phone with Carol, who has had a very weird dream about going to a theater with her husband for a cold reading. She gets there. It's dark. The lights are down. There's two spots on stage. And it turns out that it's not a cold reading, that there is a large cast dressed as Greeks. Ancient Greeks. She feels that it's she's about to be asked to be in the play. The playwright gives you the script. There's many characters, and you said there's too many characters. Who am I supposed to play? And the playwright said Uday and Kuse, and you felt horribly awkward and woke up.
Yes.
Well, you know, I think that in my head that the ancient Greeks not only representing sort of integrity in theater, but also on some level they invented democracy. You know, so on some level, it is a political dream in my head, and that there were expectations about, you know, you, where do you fit in, you know, to the political landscape. And I think that, you know, like we all feel a little alienated by the conservative trend in this country right now. Maybe the whole sort of like casting you as Uday and Kuse was just sort of the representation of your worst fears for feeling, you know, ostracized for being a liberal or a Democrat. Is that possible?
Maybe so, yes.
Because, I mean, you couldn't think of a more worse couple of guys. Like, who personifies evil even more than Hussein on some level? Or those those horrendous kids of his.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that you would be, forced to represent them in a dream, I think it's just, you know, sort of speaking to the sort of alienation we all feel in the momentum of the current administration. You okay with that one?
Yeah, I'm okay. Thank you.
All right, Carol. Take it easy.
Take care, Carol.
All right.
Wow.
I hate those kind of dreams where, you know, you really feel scared for a number of reasons.
You know, that was a middle-of-the-night dream interpretation for her, because she's in California, right?
I wonder if she just woke up. I should have asked her. She obviously lives somewhere around the same neighborhood that I live in.
Yeah.
But that was definitely a wild dream. Okay, let's get another one here. Dan, listening in Columbus. Dan, how are you?
Hey, Dan.
Good, thank you. I'm so grateful. I get on. You're going to turn my life around now.
Oh, I hope so.
All right. I have this dream almost every night.
Yes.
I'm in a strange city. I'm in a used bookstore. It's an interesting bookstore full of all kinds of little cubby holes and nooks and crannies and crowded, jumbled shelves.
Yeah.
I don't have enough time to look through it.
Oh, that's too bad. You know what? I think, how old are you?
I'm not 50.
You're in your 50s?
I quit pushing 50 a long time ago. Now I'm pulling it.
Okay. Well, you know, the weird thing about books is that, especially in a used bookstore, especially in a different town, I think this is really just one of those dreams where it's sort of like there's so many things that we want to know in this life. There are so many things we want to learn. There are so many places we want to go. There's so much wisdom and information out there that we just can't get at, and there just doesn't seem to be enough time, Dan.
I see what you mean.
You know what I mean? I think that's just one of those great dreams. Just sort of represents the fact that, like, wow, you know, there's just not enough time to get everything we want to do in and to know everything we want to know.
I can pick up the tattered pieces of my life and move on.
There you go.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
All right, so what are we doing?
You know, you're getting good at this, man.
I don't know.
you help somebody pick up the tattered pieces of their life and move on.
That's very touching, man. You know, there's something weird about, you know, sometimes we get calls, you know, that are, you know, they're obviously, you know, made up dreams, but today they've been very weird. They've been very real because you can feel the realness of a dream. You know what I mean? You know,
yeah.
There's a certain dream logic that only happens. Yeah, there's no narrative in dreams necessarily, you know. All right, let me get one more. I'm rambling. Okay, here we go. Dan in Vermont. How are you, Dan?
Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Hey, what's going on? You got a dream?
Yeah, I've had a dream a couple of times.
Yeah.
The first time I had it, I was about 7 years old, I think.
And yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, it takes place in a house I used to live in Ohio.
Yeah.
In the suburbs.
Okay.
And it starts off with walking out into our garage.
Yeah.
And there are two tanks parked in the garage.
Really?
And, well, not...
They're two, military tanks, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Military tanks. And I'm out there with my sister and our babysitter, and we're looking for my parents.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And it's a very urgent feeling situation. And so we go out into the backyard, and it's a beach, which actually didn't exist.
Yeah.
And on the beach are a bunch of Nazi soldiers, and they've got just people bent over sawhorses, and they're beating them on the back with sticks and boards.
Wow.
And the people are vomiting blood, and it's really graphic.
Wow.
We finally, after going past all these people, not saying anything, I found my parents lounging in lounge chairs, getting some sun, and they didn't really say anything, but they kind of gave us a look like, gee, where you been? And I turned and jumped in the water and just floated around with exotic fish, and the dream ends.
And you had this first when you were how old?
I was about 7.
Oh, my God. Wow. So you know, that was, and how old are you?
I'm 36.
Oh, wow. So, like, it's not even relational to World War II. It just seems to me that, I don't know, it's hard for me to read it because when you're having that dream when you're 7, it's just so, that's just such a parental context. It's like, you know, you got all these nightmares of war going on in your head and all these horrors of what life is probably really like, and then your parents are sort of just there going, take it easy. It's okay. Go in and swim with the fish. Don't pay attention to the horrors that are going on everywhere. But I think, you know, as you get older, if you're still having it, then it takes on a whole new meaning. Maybe your parents lied to you and denied the existence of all this war. And that, you know, I think that the fact that the Nazis were just had people bent over and were beating them, I think somehow that represents just, you know, our jobs in life. You know what I mean?
Wow.
That, you know, why aren't they shooting them and killing them? You know, why are they sawhorses? Why is there sort of a utilitarian kind of symbol in there of just work being done? I think that must have been added later. Was the sawhorses there when you were a kid?
Yeah, they were.
Oh, man. So it's a prophecy. You like your job?
Not really.
Wow.
I don't know. Maybe I rambled through this one, but thanks for sharing it with us, man.
Thanks a lot. I find it very significant that he's had this dream recurring for that amount of, that's almost 30 years.
Yeah, well, you know, it's weird. The beach, you know, symbolizes, I think, somewhat the change and somewhat, you know, some, you know, on the precipice of change, or some sort of, the ocean symbolizes a certain amount of peace in one's life. But, you know, the sort of realities of the world and the Nazis and, like, you know, they're just the horrors of it, yet his parents are still calm and cool and collected. And when he does go into the water, it's just him and the fish, you know, that there's a sort of, like, you know, release that seemed to come through the parents, that, you know, a feeling of safety and comfort.
Yeah, I was curious, like, you know, if it was me, I'd be saying to my parents, what are they beating Nazis in the backyard for?
Yeah,
I mean, why are the Nazis beating them? You know, like, why? What's going on?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
but
you know,
sometimes
what?
You don't always say what you need to say in a dream.
Yeah, but you know what? Next hour, we're going to be able to ask why of somebody who knows. Max Cleland, former senator from Georgia, is going to tell us whether the Democrats are done.
Dreams of the Democrats.
Or are they going to get up and fight?
Yes.
We'll talk about some gas prices and a whole lot more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
The show is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians. I want to put some stuff out there for you. I will be performing at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco on Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd. And that's not a joke. It's not April Fool's Day thing. I will be there. So you can go to Air America or MorningSedition.com. To the tour date section, get some information on that. And if you're listening to 960 AM, The Quake in San Francisco, come check it out. Also, the entire extended Milfington family is on vacation, so we're letting you vote for your favorite Milfington comedy bits here at MorningSedition.com. And we're playing the winners today. We're going to play The War on Brains coming up in a little while. Also, what else do we got? We got Max Cleland coming up.
Yeah.
That's going to be great to talk to him in a little bit. And also, I want to thank David Hinckley for spelling and getting the order right here. You know, he wrote a piece on Danny Goldberg, our new CEO, and he says, that's why the Air America lineup, heard locally on WLIB, 1190 AM, is sprinkled with hosts like Mark Maron, Al Franken, and Janine Garofalo. It's, you know what I mean? Spell my name right and put the order of significance in the proper order. Now, I'm not being self-centered or narcissistic or delusional. No, I'm just excited to see some ink on the network, and I'm excited to see my name spelled right. I got to tell you, Riley, you don't realize what I've gone through my entire life. You would think that, okay, granted, Mark with a C, a little unusual, but, you know, not that unique. But Maron baffles people. Baffles. Not even confusing. How would you spell it? I mean, I've spelled it something Marrin, Merrin, Marrin, Marron. I mean, what's the big deal?
Hey, you ever try, you know, with Riley? It's always REI. The first thing that people do, the first three letters, yeah. REI. No, I'm black. I'm not Irish. I'm black. I spell it R-I. And then they look at you.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, R-E. No, no.
R-I.
That's funny. They look at you and go, oh, you're not Irish.
You're not Irish, but it still is R-E, right? I mean, that's it's part of the, it's one
did,
of those things.
Did you ever trace your tree? Did you ever trace your family tree and figure out where the name came from?
No, but I know that my ancestors lived in both Dundee, Scotland, and Liverpool.
Really?
That's why I love British soccer today.
It's a genetic thing.
It's a genetic thing, absolutely.
My roots go right back to Russia and Poland. I am a classic sort of, you know, Eastern European Jew mutt. That's it. That's my lineage. So let's talk about, the bankruptcy legislation looks like it's going to be plowed through because Democrats, you know, a lot of them voted for cloture, right? Am I saying
cloture?
Cloture.
Yeah.
I'm learning my words, learning the words. Cloture. So they're going to, you know, refuse the filibuster. And these are senators, like, the problem now is that it's going to pass. It's got the votes it needs. But I really urge you to drop your senators a line and tell them that you think it's reprehensible. I mean, I understand Joe Biden, Tom Carper, Ben Nelson, and Tim Johnson, South Dakota, Nebraska, Delaware. They are being pimped out by the credit card companies. They owe them something for the money that they've dropped into their pockets. I'm not forgiving them that, but I understand why they did it. Do not understand why Robert Byrd, Kent Conrad, Herb Kohl, Mary Landrieu, Joe Lieberman, Blanche Lincoln, Bill Nelson, Mark Pryor, Ken Salazar, Debbie Stabenow voted against this. I don't know why.
I think it could they be picking their fights for another day? Are they now?
How long does that go on for?
I don't know. That's what we're going to ask Max Cleland.
Oh, good.
How much longer do we give the Democrats, or at least some Democrats, a pass on some of these things? Some people are still upset about the Gonzalez and Rice nominations, that more Democrats, other than Barbara Boxer, didn't stand up then. Now we're seeing these folks in the class action lawsuit part of the restricting victims' rights movement.
Right.
And now with the bankruptcy bill, we see Democrats folding over and over. And the question some people are starting to have is, when does it stop?
Right.
When do we start to see the Democrats acting with the kind of discipline that we've come to expect from the other party, for God's sake?
Well, I guess Nancy Pelosi's putting together a little something of a report that accuses the Republicans of being bullies, for the most part, and quote, severely restrict or sometimes even totally block the minority's ability to debate or amend bills. That's from the report, unquote.
And that surprises somebody?
No, but I mean,
when the Republicans are in power, this is how they're going to do their business. These guys have an agenda. They want to implement the agenda, and they're not playing about the agenda. Look at Tom DeLay, for God's sake.
The worst.
But yeah, he's the absolute worst. And, you know, the idea that he would link both his own situation in Texas with the situation in Washington, because, of course, it's the Texas legislature that determines the congressional lines that send people to Washington. DeLay understands how this game is played. And he is playing this game to win. Whatever he feels he needs to do, within whatever his definition of the law is, that's what he's going to do. And there are people who want the Democrats to be as ruthless in pursuing our agenda. The problem is nobody seems to know what our agenda is.
Yeah, we don't have a bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult legislative pig pack. That's what I'm saying. Hey, you know, the bottom line is that these, so many of these Democrats, you know, why did they do it when there are Republicans that are balking on Social Security? You know what I mean?
There are numbers of Republicans, including people who are, you know, some of George Bush's closest allies. Lindsey Graham, South Carolina. Prime example of a senator who is in George Bush's corner 90% of the time, but not on Social Security.
And some people, I think Chuck Hagel wants to up the age. I mean, I saw him on CNN yesterday. There are people that are coming out with alternate plans. There are people that are against the Bush plan. And you seem to think, Riley, as we talked about the other day, that he's going to make some sort of, you know, at least vocal compromise that really doesn't do anything to change anything and then present it as if he's done something.
Well, you know, if you listen to him, and I was listening the other day to him trying to sell this thing, the Social Security thing. And what you hear him say is, well, it's not going to cost anybody anything. He will imply that he's not going to end up cutting benefits to create these privatized accounts. He will imply that. Now, whether or not he actually has to go through with it is going to be up to the Congress. But if he says that this is going to be a supplemental situation, then you have to ask yourself, what does it actually do for the trust fund? And the answer to that is nothing. What does it do for the debt? It makes it extremely high.
Oh, it's already, you know, we're already, the future is already screwed. These guys have, you know, if they get, you know, just two of the things that they're going to, if they get this, if they fall through with the restricting victims' rights and they put this bankruptcy thing through, this bill through, the future is screwed for generations probably.
Well, and the problem, Mark, is that people see the Democrats, both friends and foes see the Democrats, as scrambling around for a strategy to fight this stuff and being constantly put in a reactive position.
We got to talk to Cleland about that. He's got to set us straight on that stuff. You know what I mean? I mean, because this bank, I don't understand why these Democrats, you know, voted, you know, why they're voting, you know, for this bankruptcy bill. It drives me nuts because I don't, you know, I want answers, Riley. You know, I think that there is satisfaction to be had. I am an immediate gratification junkie. I want to know what is going on, but you know what? Politics isn't like that. It's an evolution of whoredom. Anyways, it's 14 past the hour. We're going to talk. I want you to explain to me, how the hell are gas prices going up? I mean, how are they going up? I mean, you got to explain it to me, because there's part of me that says, you know, well, they did all that horrible stuff in Iraq, right, for oil. Then, well, this doesn't make sense, $2.15 a gallon.
Yep.
Will you explain it to me?
I will.
All right, 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest-rated, most-respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Nineteen past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Morning Sedition. The facts, the fury, the funny. Don't be stupid. It feels like thinking. That's what I like. Feels like thinking, man. The entire extended Milfington family is taking family vacation. War correspondent Mort Milfington, Rapture Watch correspondent Milf Cardinal Milfington, and Morning Remembrance grief correspondent Mort Mortensen, cousin, are all enjoying their time off. So we're going to revisit their most respected reports. Our listeners are voting for their favorites on MorningSedition.com, and right now we present your favorite, War on Brains, with Mort Milfington. Every Wednesday, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 3-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here now is war correspondent Mort Milfington with today's dispatch from the War on Brains.
Thank you, Walter. Dateline, Washington, D.C. Population, 52.9% female. Look out, gals. The odds are in my favor. October 6th. The Bush War on Brains continues, and the news is bad. Not good. Bad is not good. And not good is bad. Exhibit A, George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind Act. A massive, inexorable force that seems to crush everything in its way. Or for those of you with a great society education, a juggernaut. Unreliable test scores, flawed diagnostic criteria, and shaky data are the ingredients of George W. Bush's educational scheme. His Jenny Doo, and too numerous to count are the concerns raised by the Congressional Government Accountability Office, or CGOON, against this, the centerpiece of the Bush domestic agenda. But you already knew that, or did you? Unless you're one of them, one of the newly educated, one of the children not left behind. Now, this may be a little demanding, and I don't want to lose you, so listen up, pinheads. You can't use faulty data to decide the fate of schools. I think I could best drive this point home in a song, Mark. Have you ever seen a dream walking?
Not really, Mort.
Well, I have. Have you ever seen a dream talking?
No, Mort, I haven't.
Well, I have. Have you ever had a dream? Whisper, it's true. Honey, I love you, I do.
More, what is this? What?
Well, the dream was a walking, and the dream is a talking, and the heaven in my arms is you.
More, I'm married, and you're not gay.
Exactly, Mark. But according to your demographics, half of your echo boomer baggy pants, backwards baseball cap wearing moron fans lost their concentration shortly after I said Dateline. That's the true legacy of No Child Left Behind. I should have stayed in the SLA, man. I got more things done, and the chicks were wild. So until next time, Freedom Fighters, this is Donald DeFries saying, that's today's dispatch from the War on Brains.
All right, so we've been hearing your favorites in the Milvington family throughout the week. You can go to morningsedition.com later today to cast your vote for the best Rapture Watch report from MILF Cardinal Milvington. Then tune in Friday to hear the winner. That's weird, because that was before we started doing the banter. I don't think that I had really broken the ice with the post-segment banter Mort. Yeah, he's an odd sort.
That was Mort Milvington.
That was Mort Milvington. You know, all those
not Mort Mortensen.
No, all those Milvington fellas are weird and sound strangely the same. Am I right here?
Oh, nah.
Can I get a witness, please? All right, now here we go. Let me, Riley. This is still something I don't understand, because you know why? Because when I read things, it doesn't always stay in my head, and sometimes I have a wrong impression of stuff. Now, if U.S. gasoline prices will hit a new record high in the spring, right?
Yes.
That might reach a monthly average of $2.15 a gallon.
Yep.
Right? This is from the Energy Information Administration. Now, did they just decide this stuff randomly?
No, actually, I have their website up, and they actually explain all of this.
Energy
Information Administration. No!
All right, buddy.
I didn't know any of this before I went up on their website.
Oh, good. Let's learn. Listen and learn.
This is the deal. Now the story that you're talking about says that this will happen during the spring, that it could hit as high as $2.15 a gallon.
Okay.
The record high price was $2.06 a gallon, which was set in May of 2004. Right now, we're sitting right on the edge of $2. We're at $1.99.9 a gallon. That's up 7.1% from last week and 26.1% from last year.
Hey, can I just thank God right now that we live in a city where the public transportation is so damn good? You know, I am.
Yeah,
so...
but they had a fare increase for the subway.
Yeah, it ain't $2.15 a gallon, buddy.
No, it's $2 a ride.
It's $2 a ride. Okay, so but if you get the MetroCard, I get for $76. I get 30 rides.
That's what they raised.
No, I know.
It used to be 70. It went up to 76.
But
yeah.
Still, I'll take some extra trips every day. Unlimited Metro ride, $76. Unlimited. So, like, after the show, sometimes I'll just go up and down 3 or 4 times just to get the value.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you see Mark Maron on the train on his way to Coney Island, you'll know why.
Yeah, some of those guys that you see that never get off the train, it's just they're just trying to get their money's worth. What, Kalo? You're ready to say something.
When I used to buy the Unlimited Metro card, I would actually swipe the card for someone as I was leaving the subway.
Really?
There you go. Yeah. That's
you can't do that with them anymore, can you?
Sure. Because,
yeah, you can do it.
Yeah,
you can do it.
But you can?
Yeah.
But not going in, because if you swipe it when you go in. And
no, I mean after I've ridden the subway already and I'm leaving.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. So you're taking money out of our pocket in a kind of a way.
No, he's an altruist, man. He's paying for somebody else's ride.
Oh.
He's not taking money out of anybody's pocket. He already paid.
It's called being nice.
It's being a nice guy.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the fuel producers, the gasoline and oil producers, aren't being nice. Last I saw, the barrel of crude was going for something on the order of $54.
Yeah.
Now, of course, crude oil accounts for 51% of the price of a gallon of gasoline at the pump. The rest is refining, distribution and marketing, and taxes. Taxes, 24%. So that's a pretty high nut right there.
But somebody, and I'm assuming it's friends of this administration, are making a fortune every time this thing goes up a nickel, right?
Well, yeah, the oil-producing countries are making out like bandits through all this. And by the way, the spring prediction assumes an increase in consumption that is probably going to happen. You know, whenever it gets warm outside, when the winter finally gets past, folks get in their cars, they go places.
So this is just business, is what you're telling me.
This is just business. What it is reflective of a rise in the price of crude. The crude oil prices have been going up. Fortunately for most consumers, diesel prices are going up faster, and there's a bigger gap over this past winter between gas and diesel prices. So gas prices have remained not as bad as buying for diesel. And diesel, of course, trucks and all the rest of those folks use that, so they're getting hit hard. I
imagine they've got to be strapped.
Well, yeah, the average price of diesel right now is $2.16 a gallon.
Oh, my God.
So they're already up over the $2.15 rate.
Those truckers we talked to have got to be like, damn.
Yeah, and you know what? There's not a whole heck of a lot that consumers can do.
a boycott doesn't work because of the nature of the business. What you can do, though, is search out the lowest price in your neighborhood, in your area, and you might be able to force another retailer who's higher to lower prices.
Or you can do what Chris does and just, like, get some people on the train for nothing. Now, I didn't know you could do that, and it's nice of you to do that, especially the guys that need to live on the train.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And next time, I'm going to do it, too. I don't care.
There you go.
Yeah. So we're going to come back. We're going to talk to Senator Max Cleland, Senator Max Cleland.
We're going to talk to former Senator Max Cleland about whether or not there is any, let me see, how best to put this, because I don't want to say NADS. That's the wrong thing. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Reilly on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition Program. That's good to be back. That was a nice break, wasn't it, that we just had for 5 minutes? Very enjoyable.
Feels relaxed. Like recess.
Took a nap. Here, right now, we're very pleased to have the former senator from Georgia. He's a research fellow at the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. The author of two books, Strong at the Broken Places and Going for the Max, 12 Principles for Living Life to the Fullest. Good morning, Max Cleland. How are you?
Well, good morning, Mark and Mark.
Good morning.
Mark squared this morning.
That's right. That's us. So tell me something. What? How come all these Democratic senators voted against cloture, voted for cloture, and are getting on board with this bankruptcy bill?
Well, I tell you, as Harry Reid has said, you know, you got to pick your battles.
All right.
I think one of the battles that Democratic senators fight, and that Democrats around the country should fight in this battle to preserve Social Security. I mean, you know, the president has put himself out there as wanting to gamble with Social Security. And quite frankly, that's a disastrous, because if we just did what President Clinton said a few years ago, save Social Security first by bringing down the deficit and using that money to extend the life of Social Security, we'd be in good shape. But this crowd wants to expand the deficit. Gamble with Social Security, and that is disastrous for tens of millions of Americans out there.
Well, what I'm wondering, Senator, is like, just, you know, I mean, I don't understand. Maybe I'm naive. Is like, why can't these guys, just out of principle, you know, vote against whatever the Republicans are putting forward, just to show that there's some unity?
Well, there can be unity, and they could, like you say, you got to pick your battles.
Right.
You have to make sure that what you fight, you got a shot to delay or deny. And I think also this is shaping up for the elections in 2006. And so I do think that the Democrats have a shot at stemming this tide, because I think it's immoral to compromise Social Security. The most vulnerable in our society are going to get messed over here by this president and these Republicans if they succeed.
Absolutely.
And so they've already messed up Medicare. The two most important social safety net programs that we have today in our country, this crowd wants to undo. Now, more and more Americans are getting that message. You find that in the polling data that a majority of the Americans, particularly those who are potential recipients of Social Security, are very much opposed to this. And in battleground states like Florida, where Senator Bill Nelson is up, this is going to be a powerful issue in the Democrats' favor, and will work against the president in that state and around the country.
But, Max Cleland, it seems as though the president, in saying that he's open to all different kinds of ideas, in saying at a point, at least the Treasury Secretary Snow, saying that the president might not rule out completely the possibility of making this an ancillary supplemental program rather than cutting benefits, doesn't that invite some Democrats to get on board with him on this?
No, what they're doing is they're crawfishing on this thing, because more and more Republicans are backing off because this is a political disaster. And so the White House is crawfishing here. I mean, they're going sideways here. When they ran up against the opposition of the president's program, they said, well, baby, we're overextended here. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're overextended in Iraq in terms of foreign policy. They're one ally in the world. Tony Blair may get beaten because of this issue. We're alone in the world. And the president's now alone out there on the gangplank with his Social Security proposal. And more and more Americans are seeing that that this is a disaster and they should cut him off the gangplank and let him drop. That's why the White House is moving sideways on it.
Now, Senator, what about this memo from James Carville that essentially argues the point that Democrats cannot afford to only be against Social Security? They have to present an alternative vision for the program, and that has to kind of run through everything that they do politically. Does he have a point?
I do think Carville is right here. The Raging Cajun is right on point in terms of the fact that Democrats cannot be seen just as obstructionists, shall we say, as the White House likes to paint them. But they have to make sure that they articulate what they're for. Well, Bill Clinton was very clear a few years ago, save Social Security first. And you do that by lowering the deficit. You do that by moving toward a balanced budget. You don't do that by profligate spending and tax cuts. At the same time, you got a massive war going on, costing $100 billion a year.
You take
the proceeds that you save from the deficit and apply that to extending the life of Social Security and Medicare, and that's a winning formula. Clinton had it; he put it right up front. And that should be the Democrats' message, and I think it can be.
All right, well, let's broaden that message a little bit. You say that we can't just be seen as obstructionists in terms of whatever the Republicans put forth, and I still don't quite understand, you know, why not? You know, and on another level, it's like, you know, what are the other broader principles of the Democratic Party? Why does it seem that we are sort of without an anchor here?
Well, but the basic broad principle of the Democratic Party was articulated by President Roosevelt, who said that the purpose of politics is to generate hope. He and the Democratic Congress generated hope for millions of Americans of this generation, what became known as the greatest generation, my mother and daddy's generation, that survived the Great Depression, fought World War II, and built the country. But now they exist on Medicare and Social Security, and Franklin Roosevelt put together Social Security. And this president wants to undo that and throw it up to the stock market and put it in the hands of people who gave us WorldCom and Enron and all of that kind
right.
of stuff and the dot-com crash. We don't need that. That's social insecurity, and more people understand that, and that's why the Democrats are going to use this as their wedge issue in the campaigns of 2006 and should, because we should stand firmly for Social Security, not for social insecurity, and this president is risking the greatest social safety net program that this country's ever known.
Right.
Former Senator Max Cleland, I'm curious about your reaction to the nomination of John Bolton as ambassador to the UN. The guy has been extremely critical of the UN. Isn't this part of the new boldness coming out of the Bush administration?
It's called arrogance and hubris and overreach, and it is a not-so-subtle message to the United Nations that they don't count. It is part of the neocon strategy to go it alone in the world. Now, that is a formula for disaster. For 100 years, this country, with its great presidents, has realized in a bipartisan way that this country, no matter how strong we are, cannot go it alone. Woodrow Wilson pushing the League of Nations, which Republicans opposed, by the way, after World War I. Then finally, after the disastrous loss of life, of millions of lives in World War II, of President Roosevelt and ultimately Truman creating the United Nations, and then NATO, and then Eisenhower was the first commander of NATO. And these alliances, collective security, that has been the strategy, bipartisan strategy, for almost 100 years in coping with the dangers of the world. This president has created a tremendous breach with that history and that successful past, and now has created a massive disaster in the Middle East, in Iraq, where we're bleeding and dying, and that war is going south further and further every day. And there is no hope of an exit strategy because there is no one else in there to turn it over to. So we are in deep, deep trouble. And now they want to pull together their own go-it-alone strategy where every American in the country just goes it alone, pull out Medicare,
yeah.
pull out Social Security. This is the formula for disaster for our country. More and more Americans are seeing it.
Now, let me get back to this issue. So in terms of picking your battles, our phone's lit up, Senator. I mean, you know, and we don't have time here with you because you've got to move along to take calls. But I got a guy on the phone right now that wants to know, look, you know, sporting teams go out to win every day. Why do we have to pick our battles as Democrats? Why can't we just be fighting all the time?
Well, I think that's a good point. I think some members of the Senate do fight all the time. But
You know, you got to pick your battles in order to make sure that you are a viable alternative here to the Republicans. Not just opposing all the time, but putting forward some kind of creative solution. And they have overstepped. They've overstepped in Iraq. They've overstepped on Social Security.
Right.
And they've overstepped on Medicare. And these issues are going to resonate throughout the country, particularly in 06. All of this is staging. The sad part about it is this president is all about staging for the next election. They're not interested in really completing a good program or making it work, whether it's war or whether it's Social Security. They're all about wedge issues, 30-second negative character assassination ads for 06. That's what they're doing.
Is there a risk?
You do have to be smart and not just oppose everything. You got to pick your battles, and the real important ones you got to win.
But is there a possibility that we're getting myopic, that we're getting too that Social Security becomes the only issue?
No, it becomes the wedge issue of the 2006 campaign.
What about fiscal irresponsibility on behalf of the Republicans?
That's another wedge issue because Cheney told the first Bush Secretary of Treasury deficits don't matter. Reagan proved that, but deficits do matter. And they pull down this economy. Even Alan Greenspan now is concerned about the growing deficit because it's drowning our economy. We're drowning in red ink. When South Korea, which we created and has supported for 50 years, will not even buy U.S. government bonds anymore because we're a bad investment,
right,
we are in deep trouble. And thanks to this president, we're getting worse every day. That is an issue and a powerful issue, the deficit. But I would say the number one issue is Social Security. That's what people feel and understand in their pocketbook and in their lives. And I think the Democrats have an excellent chance to use that in 2006 and fight that battle and fight it all the way.
But, Max Gleeland, right now the Bush administration is projecting itself as being on a roll. They got the class action thing passed. The bankruptcy bill is almost passed. And he's trumpeting all of these triumphs in the Middle East, the Iraqi elections, Lebanon, the whole nine yards. How does the Democratic Party counter this veneer of success?
It is a veneer of success, and to a certain extent it is real success. The president won, despite the best efforts of Democrats. He knocked out Kerry, he knocked out Daschle.
Some people would argue with you.
And so, they are on a roll to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
And they're full of themselves. The point is they've overreached. The impact of the policy in Iraq will become increasingly clear as an American disaster, an American tragedy, another American Vietnam, and it is every day.
Okay.
Secondly, they have overreached domestically. They're outspending their capacity to fund, and it is creating a massive economic undertow that is pulling this economy down.
Yes.
And third, they're messing with the lives of Americans, the most vulnerable Americans in this country, those on Medicare and certainly those on Social Security. That is not the American way. And more people are going to understand that.
Thank you very much for joining us, Max Cleeland. You take care and have a good day.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Look, folks, I know that a lot of you are calling with questions for Max, but he had to get to other appointments. So now what we want to do is we'll take some calls and your reaction to what Mr. Cleland had to say and whatever's on your mind after this. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
To one past the hour, land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Air America Radio. Morning Sedition. You know, Riley, I just had that moment where I'm like looking around here, like I got off of my stool. You know,
man, you're sitting down. What's up?
I'm sitting down here in the chair. I usually sit on a stool, the stool that I finished this. I stained it and everything for my one-man show, and now it's like become part of me. And I walk down the halls here after every show dragging my stool and my mug. I look like Steve Martin at the end of The Jerk. But I started thinking, like, wow, when we get those new studios, dude, we're going to be like in a spaceship. Because these studios are so, like, they're kind of clunky. Am I wrong?
Well, they
were
modern.
Around a while.
They were modern when I got here. Of course, yeah. That was a decade ago.
Here we go. Here we go. What are we doing? This is BI News 5000. This is a machine I got to put the headlines through. Let's start from the New York Times. Data is lacking on Iran's arms, U.S. panel says. Let's put that into the translator. Here we go. Data is lacking on Iran's arms, U.S. panel says. Translation, Iran invasion requires new phony pretext. Yes. From Fox News, report, U.S. infrastructure crumbling. U.S. infrastructure crumbling. Translation, U.S. tax dollars finance new highways in Baghdad. Yes, from the Associated Press, coach accused of licking players' cuts. Really? Let's put that in. Coach accused of licking players' cuts. Translation, cash-strapped schools seek health care alternatives. Yeah.
I loved it.
Caleb caught one of these during Max Cleland. He caught one.
Oh, was that what that was?
Like five.
Come on. Like five. Maybe, okay, I've got to hone my radio skills. I'm sorry. You know, I'll try and watch it. But I thought it was far enough away. This isn't far enough?
Oh, please.
All right, I'm
not
sorry.
Not quite.
Let's take some calls. People are reacting to Max Cleland. Mark in Missouri on Sirius. How are you, Mark?
Hey, Mark.
Doing fine, Mark. What's
on your mind, man?
Max Cleland said that the Republicans had overstepped on Social Security and Medicare, and he doesn't think they overstepped on tort reform and bankruptcy. Can the Democrats only fight one battle at a time?
I know. I was sort of trying to get that out of him. You know, I kind of asked him three times in different words, you know, why can't they just stand up to all of this stuff? And he kept doing that pick the one battle thing. You know, I don't know. We just didn't get that answer out of him. Thanks for your call, Mark. You know, I mean, he's got a good point, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is, people who follow politics don't like to see concessions. That's not something that is unique or peculiar to progressives or to conservatives. There's a wing of the conservative Republican Party that does not want to see George W. Bush concede anything. They want to get Roe v. Wade overturned. They want Social Security turned back. They want to do all
right.
These different things, and they don't really want to compromise anything. The other side of it is there are people who look to do incremental changes, of which class action and bankruptcy are two. And they get them passed, and then they can move on to the next step.
But the question is like, why aren't the Democrats, you know, collectively, you know, moving, trying to do everything they can to rally against all of these things? I don't know why he couldn't answer that. I know there are concessions that need to be made.
No. See, understand what I'm saying. What I'm saying is these folks, the folks that do the incremental work.
Yeah.
Put forward legislation that does the work for them.
Okay. So
in other words, they introduce bills. That are incremented. Bankruptcy is one increment.
Right. And granted, okay, you know, the Democrats put a lot, they tried to push you a lot of amendments on that thing. I mean, they did a lot.
Amendments, but no bill.
So you're saying they should have put a bill?
They should put
an alternative bill?
An alternative bill, and they have to start putting out bills that speak to issues that are germane to their vision. That's what the Republicans are doing.
So are they doing that? Are they secretly doing that? Or
you heard of any bills?
No, I haven't.
That's what I mean.
All right, do we have time for one more quick call? Okay, let's do Georgina in New Jersey. How are you, Georgina?
Okay, good. Max Cleland, what I believe, is a victim of vote rigging and unfair elections.
Yes.
In Georgia. Now, what's to say that, I mean, 02 and 04, I believe, were unfair elections. What's to say 06 and 08 is going to be any different? And what I feel that is maybe the Democrats that are in office know that, and they're just in line to be reselected.
So what are you saying? But what?
I think they're all just caving in because I just feel like we don't have free and fair elections. And until we do, nothing's going to change.
So you think that that's really what the Democrats in the House and the Senate are thinking? It's like, you know what? None of it's fair. To hell with it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. None of it's fair to hell with it.
I don't think that's the case, but I think she makes a good point for election reform. But I do think, like you're saying, Riley, is that, you know, if stuff is done through legislation, that has an impact. I think that, honestly, they're a little selfish and a little worried about their own careers. Oh, I'm sorry.
Fear factor.
Don't worry. It's coming. It's coming from the Streisand compound.
I had to go over to the machine to get it. Here's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. One, bribe the doctors who are draining Bill Clinton's chest for some of the fluid. Begin cloning the 53rd president of the United States of America. Get the fluid. Two, now that the White House is credentialing bloggers, push to get credentials for people who stand around the water cooler saying what a jerk George Bush is.
Yeah.
Is that our last recourse? Three, urge a boycott of the Vin Diesel film The Pacifier. There's nothing politically incorrect about it, but God, what a crappy idea for a movie. Four, in honor of Irish American Heritage Month, boycott those whose actions are destroying Irish culture, the British, the Catholic Church, and the creator of Riverdance. Five, today's phrase, slip it into conversation, John R. Bolton belongs at the United Nations about as much as Michael Bolton belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Wake up, sheeple, they're ruining the last hope for world peace and classic R&B.
Now, tomorrow, Mark Maron.
Yes.
We're putting Brendan P.W. McDonald, we're putting him out on a secret mission. We're not going to tell you about it now. You got to listen tomorrow morning, but I guarantee it's going to be good. Have a good one, Maron.
You too, Riley.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.